This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we consider the popular uprising against ALEC, the American Legislative Executive Council, which has been pushed back over the Stand Your Ground law and has also lost several corporate sponsors. We'll assess how much more work remains to be done with Lisa Graves of PR Watch and the ALEC Exposed website. Also, with new American military offensives underway in Afghanistan, we'll consider how long the Obama administration intends to remain inside the country with Voices for Creative Nonviolence Director Kathy Kelly, who has recently returned from Afghanistan. All that and more. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And over the past few weeks, particularly in the wake of the Trayvon Martin killing, there has been a tremendous reaction across the country to a surreptitious legislative body called ALEC that has been funded by conservative sources and in nearly half the states of this nation pushed forward carbon copies of the NRA-approved law, the so-called Stand Your Ground law. The outrage over the killing of Trayvon Martin has brought more attention to the organization that has long been covered by PR Watch and by the website ALEC Exposed, and the director thereof, our guest live today, Lisa Graves. Lisa, welcome back to 5 o'clock shadow.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, congratulations on your research and work and the pushback that seems to have taken place in regard to some elements of this legislative juggernaut. Can you bring us up to date on how far the Stand Your Ground law has been pushed back and the consequences of its exposure?
Sure. Well, ALEC, which is the acronym for the American Legislative Exchange Council, is a group that describes itself as one of the largest groups of state legislators in the country. But in reality, it is a group that is largely funded by corporations and CEO foundations. And what ALEC does is it gets your state legislator off to a resort somewhere in the country where state elected officials actually vote behind closed doors on legislation as equals with corporate lobbyists on legislation that's the template legislation to change the laws in several states. And so what's happened here is that a particular bill in Florida that was cited by many as an excuse to prevent the arrest and prosecution of George Zimmerman, who shot and killed Trayvon Martin, that law, after it was passed in Florida, was taken by the NRA's hired lobbyist, a woman named Marion Hammer, to a secret closed-door meeting in Texas of the ALEC Task Force on Criminal Justice. And at that secret meeting, where no press or public was present, the NRA urged the politicians present along with the corporations present to embrace that bill as a model bill nationally. That meeting was co-chaired by Walmart, which is the largest seller of long guns and ammunition in the United States. And at that meeting, the NRA's proposal was unanimously approved and well-received. And since that time in 2005, bills that resemble that Florida law, bills that echo the ALEC model, have been speeding through state houses across the country. To date, the NRA brags that over 34 states have adopted that bill in whole or in part.
My goodness, the last time I counted, I thought it was only about two dozen or so. 30?
Well, two dozen appear to be quite close on all three of the major provisions, and another 10 have adopted two of the three major provisions in that bill.
One of the things that has happened because of the public concern over the proliferation of weapons and reckless use thereof is that several sponsors have withdrawn from ALEC. We're aware so far of McDonald's, Wendy's, Kraft, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and Intuit, Mars, I guess that's the candy manufacturer, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Can you verify that and tell us if there are perhaps others and what this financial impact might have to do with the operation of ALEC?
Well, that's correct. Those corporations that you've listed have all indicated publicly in the last few weeks that they are no longer supporting ALEC, although some of them have given different stories for why they're suddenly out of ALEC. And will no longer be funding them. In addition, in the last hour, we've learned that Blue Cross Blue Shield, which has been a previous funder of ALEC, has announced that it's no longer going to be participating in ALEC. And we've also heard from a number of other corporations, including Ticketmaster, who previously had given some donations to ALEC, that they want to make sure that people understand that they're no longer a part of ALEC. And so there's been a real exodus of corporations, of brand name corporations from ALEC, as people become more aware of ALEC's agenda. And so that's what's been happening lately, along with efforts by not just our work at ALEC Exposed to connect these dots and do this research and tell these stories, but work by groups like Color of Change and Common Cause, People for the American Way, the American Progress Groups, and others that have really gone out to their members and said, hey, did you have any idea that this company like Kraft that you may rely on actually has been providing financial support for ALEC, and here's part of ALEC's agenda? But today we've just learned that ALEC has announced that it will no longer have a Criminal Justice and Elections Task Force. This is the task force that ratified the Florida law as a model bill. It's the same task force that ratified so-called voter ID bills that have been now coursing across the country that make it more difficult for American citizens to vote, that task force has been disbanded. And yet ALEC wants credit for doing so, while they don't appear to be intending to lift a finger to reverse those bills, to reverse the damage done, and in particular on the case of these voter suppression bills that are going to make it more difficult for college students, people who don't drive and have driver's licenses but have other forms of ID to be able to vote this fall. ALEC isn't going to do a thing to reverse that voter suppression that they backed before.
Well, we appreciate the early word of the withdrawal of Blue Cross Blue Shield from the ALEC Consortium. I guess it makes sense in a way because they'd have to cover fewer gunshot wounds as a result of this legislation. And can you give us some idea about what percentage of the total funding of ALEC, these handful or a dozen or approaching a dozen corporations withdrawal means? Is that really where most of their money comes from? Do they have deep pockets from some parent organization? How do they stay afloat?
Well, sure, that's a great question. ALEC keeps that information very secret, but I think a conservative estimate would be that this has cost them at least $500,000 in terms of members saying that they don't want to be associated with the NRA's extreme gun agenda. It may be much more than that because we don't know the full total of corporations that have been involved in ALEC. ALEC claims that it has over 300 corporations or special interest groups that are its members, in addition to legislative members.
Don't the 990s give some indication, the tax forms that are required to have some kind of disclosure?
Well, that's a great question. What those tax forms show is that less than 2% of ALEC's total $7 million budget comes from legislative dues, the dues of legislative members. It does not disclose how the other 98% breaks down. It's largely, however, from corporations and sometimes from foundations like the Gates Foundation, which recently indicated that it will not be providing ALEC with an additional grant beyond the $300,000-plus it had given previously. And so it's not clear how much ALEC's funding has been affected by this exodus, but certainly they've been showing signs of desperation. They actually put like a 12-inch by 3-inch donate button on their homepage last week, which was kind of, I think, the biggest donate button I've ever seen in my life on a website, especially for an organization that actually isn't supported really from grassroots donations from ordinary individuals. That it's an organization that's largely supported by some of the richest corporations in the world, and it does have some deep pockets. Koch Industries is a longtime funder of ALEC. It sits on its board. It's been the chairman of ALEC's board. That's the corporation that is led by the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch, who are the two of the richest billionaires in the world. Back in the 1990s, when ALEC was on the ropes financially, the Koch family, in essence, authorized a nearly $500,000 loan to ALEC to keep it afloat. And so it does have some big resources to go to, including the tobacco industry, which is a long-standing part of the ALEC agenda, as well as the asbestos industry, which has been working with ALEC to try to prevent American consumers who have been harmed by asbestos, who may be dying from a mesothelioma or asbestosis or other asbestos-related injuries, from getting justice if the corporation gets sold to another corporation, so that the successor corporation gets the assets but not the liabilities. So there are some big financial interests that have been backing ALEC and benefiting from ALEC. Those guys like Koch, the Koch brothers, don't seem to be going away.
Can ALEC perhaps wire home for additional money from the Heritage Foundation and their conservative progenitors?
Well, the Heritage Foundation is in some ways a sister or brother organization to ALEC. It was co-founded by the same man who co-founded ALEC. That's Paul Weyrich, who passed away a few years ago, who was a right-wing activist who responded to calls for businesses to get more involved in public policy by creating groups like ALEC and Heritage Foundation. I suspect it's more likely that the common funders of ALEC and Heritage will be sought out, and those common funders include the Koch brothers and the Koch family foundations.
Well, one of the things that has been done is the retrenchment, or at least the announcement, however useful that announcement is, about the legislative task force on criminal law being, put in the penalty box, suspended, or under reduced operation. But does that really mean that the agenda of ALEC has been brought to a stop? Maybe they're playing possum, because the gun law, the stand your ground law, is not the only area that they have been active in, and you alluded to some of those, and there seems to be a xenophobic mission about their agenda with the immigration laws, and what some would say is an anti-democratic agenda with the voter ID laws that would be selectively applied to people of a certain hue. Can you take us through each of those other initiatives, which may perhaps encroach on the very democracy that the legislative councils purport to support?
Well, those are examples of bills that were approved by the ALEC Criminal Justice and Elections Task Force, the Public Safety and Elections Task Force. The bill on the bill to say that these voter ID bills should be a national model was approved with the NRA, the National Rifle Association, as the co-chair. Similarly, the bill that was passed in Arizona, the controversial SB 1070, that has had a devastating impact on the local economy in Arizona, as well as on immigrant families in Arizona. That bill was ratified after the fact by this same task force as an ideal bill, and then subsequently was introduced in other states like Alabama. The prison privatization binge, the whole industry, the multi-billion dollar industry that has emerged to take Americans' tax dollars out of the public prisons and put them into private prisons where there's profit sharing for prison wardens. And where these prison companies seek to get a guarantee from states for a certain number of beds, in essence a vacancy rate of only 10%, that their beds will always be 90% full, or the state will pay up to that amount for prisoners. These corporations have been longtime members of ALEC. CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America, is no longer a member of ALEC, but it was for well over a decade, and its agenda was implemented in numerous states. And so there's a number of bills that were embraced by ALEC, ratified by ALEC, promoted by ALEC, that were made possible through the bankrolling of ALEC's operations by numerous Fortune 500 corporations, and those bills remain. They remain on the books. And so today's announcement by ALEC, which I think does show the strength of the grassroots movement in this country, it does show the strength of ordinary citizens raising their voices and saying that they don't want corporations playing this kind of role in policy and politics. That's a strong statement for the power of the grassroots and how they should be even more empowered. But in terms of ALEC's agenda, they have not indicated that they're going to lift a finger to reverse the damage that their policies have done. And this isn't the only area. ALEC's agenda in their supposed jobs agenda is quite extreme. For example, they have a bill they're pushing that's in their so-called tort agenda, which would make it impossible for you to sue if your husband or wife is killed by a dangerous drug that was approved by the FDA. So even though we've seen day after day, in fact, month after month, of recalls of drugs in this country that were approved by the apparently inadequate process of the FDA, these drug companies want to hide behind that FDA approval and deny you any chance of getting to court to get damages for the loss of your loved one and the lost income, even if their product is recalled. unless, you know, except for in very rare circumstances. And so this isn't about, you know, jobs. This isn't about corporate responsibility. This is about corporate irresponsibility. It's about saying that ALEC will continue to push an agenda that advantages corporations to the detriment of ordinary people and makes it more difficult for ordinary people to get their day in court if they're injured or killed by corporations, or if they lose their job, to make it more difficult for public workers and private workers to negotiate to keep their jobs, to make it more difficult for cities to pass resolutions to protect workers and ensure that people get sick leave so they can take care of their families when they're sick, to make it more difficult to get health care reform in this country. ALEC's agenda is an extreme agenda. It's not just in the area of guns and voting.
We're speaking with Lisa Graves of ALECExposed.org, as well as PR Watch. And I commend to our listeners' attention your website, because you have the legislation that is being pushed forward by ALEC on such areas as you have mentioned in regard to tort reform and pharmaceuticals and income support and so on, as well as environmental and energy initiatives. And that website is alecexposed.org. And Lisa, has ALEC been involved in the avalanche of repressive legislation and personal tracking and loss of privacy as reflected in the Patriot Act and the National Identification Initiatives? Are they a part of that establishment of a surveillance and or police state in some of the bills they represent?
Well, that is a really insightful question. Interestingly enough, ALEC has been defended by the Cato Institute, which is right now in a struggle for control with the Koch brothers, who are longtime, the Koch family interests, which are longtime members of the Cato board. And Cato has gone forward to claim that that ALEC is no big deal and that ALEC has defended libertarian principles. But I've looked at their bills, and I'll tell you what, ALEC has a resolution unequivocally supporting the Patriot Act without change. Oh. They issued that bill in the middle of the Bush administration to back up the Bush administration. They didn't call for any increased protections for civil liberties in the Patriot Act, despite manifest documentation of abuse of the powers and misuse of the powers by the FBI and other agencies. And so they have stood behind the Patriot Act without reservation. They did one resolution opposing what's known as Real ID, which was a requirement to have state driver's license bureaus get involved in a national ID system. But meanwhile, they've pushed these bills on voter suppression, this particular bill that they call the voter ID bill, without any documented evidence of any substantial fraud in the U.S. in voting. In fact, you know, I've worked at a prosecutor's office before, and I'll tell you what, they're not soft on crime. If there was an epidemic of voter fraud in this country, they'd be prosecuting it. It's just not real. It's a hypothetical, hyped-up risk that in exchange they're pushing for changing ID rules to make it more difficult for Americans to vote. So while they claim they're libertarian, I'll tell you what, it's not really libertarianism as I've seen it. In fact, a lot of the measures they push are designed to protect industries, to protect corporations. It's sort of crony capitalism at its worst, because it's intended to not hold corporations accountable, in fact, to make them not accountable. And even in their rhetoric, in opposition to the number of good government and watchdog groups that have come out to express concerns, they've claimed that the people who would dare to use consumer power to hold these corporations accountable are somehow socialist or leftist or even fascist, in the words of Bill O'Reilly, are absurd, because, quite frankly, if this is supposed to be about capitalism and the free market system, then these companies ought to be sensitive to the demands of their consumers.
Lisa, I'm concerned that there is a meta problem as well, where these privileged and well-funded star chambers of legislation create an environment in which being a dissident becomes too costly for cowardly politicians. In particular, let's just take an example of the Patriot Act. I see very little difference between ALEC and President Obama, who re-signed the bill, and the Democrats and the Republicans of the United States Congress, all of whom voted for its renewal. So do you see that as being something that makes people who might otherwise do the right thing not do the right thing?
Well, I have to say, as someone who has spent a number of years trying to get the Patriot Act reformed, I'm deeply disappointed by members of both parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, that have not insisted on crucial changes to protect civil liberties and to protect the freedom of dissent in this country, and in fact have unfortunately allowed the Bush administration policies to be entrenched and to deepen in some ways. I personally have tremendous disappointment at that, at what's happened, and the level of control and influence of the national security infrastructure in cowing politicians. But I think that that's part of a, in some ways, it's part of a similar issue or similar problem, which is sometimes described as the capture of legislators by the bodies that they're supposed to be regulating. And so in the case of national security, you have government bodies, including Senate and House oversight committees, that are tasked with overseeing that industry, in essence, the national security industry, and yet they spend so much time in some ways with representatives of that industry that they become captured in some ways by the information provided or by the influence of that industry. And I think that's deeply troubling in a democracy, because those agencies are supposed to be protecting our interests, and those politicians have much less contact in many respects with civil libertarians and from either political party or no political party who are concerned. Similarly, here you have an instance where, in manifest ways, what ALEC does is it provides special access, extra access, to the corporations that are supposed to be regulated by these politicians. And so you have corporations that are doing business before the state, that might be regulated industries before the states, that are getting going on these special trips down to ALEC meetings at fancy resorts, where they get special access to these politicians to push their agenda. And in fact, through ALEC task forces, these unelected corporate lobbyists are given an equal vote to the elected officials in so-called model legislation. I'm actually stunned that any elected official would debase himself or herself so much that they would actually allow themselves to go into a closed-door room and give an equal vote to unelected corporate lobbyists and special interest lobbyists. As someone who worked hard to try to get the Patriot Act reformed when I was working for the ACLU and the Center for National Security Studies, there, I'll tell you what, no politician ever told me that I got an equal vote, and they shouldn't have. The best I would hope is that they would listen to me and hear my concerns, but what ALEC does is totally different than ordinary lobbying. This is where politicians and corporations actually vote as equals behind closed doors on model legislation to change your rights, and then those politicians come back to their state house and introduce those bills, cleansed of any reference to the fact that they were already pre-voted on by corporations and sometimes themselves in these backdoor ALEC meetings.
Well said. Lisa Graves of PR Watch, you're the executive director there and also a leader of the website ALECExposed.org. And you certainly give us pause for thought in that this social process is a way of privatizing the law in the same way that ALEC is advocating for privatizing the schools. There's one other issue that I think is of great importance here, and that is the disenfranchisement of more than half the world. The laws that are being promulgated in regard to personal health and the freedom of choice in regard to a woman's right to choose to abort or not. And is there any involvement of ALEC and related people in the continually phallocentric laws that are attempting to control women's bodies?
Well, it is the case that when ALEC was first founded by Paul Weyrich and some of the other social conservative or right-wing activists like Henry Hyde, the former representative from Illinois, its agenda at that time in the 1970s included some of these sorts of social issues, because both of those men were, in essence, vehemently anti-choice, anti-women's reproductive rights. But ALEC's current portfolio doesn't include any of those bills. However, at ALEC conventions, it has a sort of a Lollapalooza little gathering of special interest groups that buy booths in order to get one-stop shopping access to these legislators from across the country. And there are a couple of groups that are regular booth funders of ALEC that are pushing an anti-choice agenda, an agenda to weaken the rights of American women and, you know, perhaps others across the world in terms of their reproductive freedom and their power to have the power to have access to the birth control that they or their doctors recommend. And so while ALEC itself does not have those bills on its agenda, bills to limit women's rights are routinely passed out at ALEC conventions through these through the booths that they have that are sponsored by groups that are anti-women's reproductive freedom.
In your research in regard to ALEC, have you come across another legislative lobbying organization that is pushing forward on repressing women's rights, and that is a group called Americans United for Life, which seems to be moving in a parallel path on the issue of reproductive rights?
I haven't seen them there. I think that the group that we have seen most frequently, it does not have that name. It's a different anti-choice group. But I will definitely redouble my efforts and take a closer look to see if we have any documentation of that group's role in part in funding ALEC through these convention booths.
Well, I cannot more highly recommend your website than to say that it is the most authoritative, the most detailed and thorough revelation of the shadow government that is underway in America. And I congratulate you, Lisa, you and your colleagues, on the part you've had in exposing this clandestine conspiracy of law. And I'd like you in these closing moments to reflect upon how the populist forces, the freedom of choice forces, the constitutional supporters of America have moved forward to push back this initiative. How has this much victory been achieved, and is it a sufficient amount of victory?
Well, I would have to say that, you know, when I think Americans saw what was happening in Tahrir Square in Egypt with people standing up against an extremely regressive and violent regime, you could hear in some ways an echo here in the U.S. when people in Wisconsin, in the state where CMD is located, where PR Watch and ALEC Expose is located, were standing up against the extraordinary policies of Scott Walker, the governor here who was an ALEC alum. And people started talking about how some of these bills that were designed to strip workers of their rights and limit their collective bargaining rights had some ALEC DNA, that they were part of perhaps an ALEC agenda. That uprising in Wisconsin of over 100,000 people in the deepest heart of winter on extremely cold, below zero days, people coming out from all walks of life, from every background, standing up to protect their rights, to defend, in essence, the American way of life and the middle class and the American dream and opportunities, I think that was very inspiring. I think since that time, we've obviously seen the Occupy movement, which is also engaged in highlighting ALEC and making sure people, more and more people, know what ALEC is, along with bloggers, activists, as well as traditional journalists who have dug into our website at ALEC Exposed and helped connect those dots between the ALEC corporations, the ALEC bills, and the ALEC politicians. I think we're seeing a surge in citizen engagement and in working to hold corporations accountable for having undue influence in our political process, undue influence in our policy process, a process that really in a democracy ought to be held sacred and cherished as the domain of ordinary individual people. That's what it means to be in a democracy, as opposed to, you know, a kleptocracy, or as opposed to a democracy in which only the most powerful people have a say or a vote, an oligarchy. We believe that this democracy, our democracy, is worth fighting for and saving and shining a light on corruption. And that's one of the reasons why we have worked so hard to make sure people have the resources available through alecexposed.org to tell these stories in their own states and show how corporations are exerting excessive influence on our policy and to reclaim our democracy.
Brava. Thomas Jefferson could not have said it better. Thank you, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much.
Lisa is the executive director of PR Watch, but we also commend your attention to the website alecexposed.org, where you can both be enlightened and support this kind of investigative work. Thank you once again, Lisa.
Thank you so much.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We'll be back with more on Afghanistan after this victory lap.
Mine is in your- that we're two from the good black men.
Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions, we're a winner, keep on pushing. And we're today considering the pushback of a repressive legislative lobby, ALEC, and a new putsch by the United States and NATO in Afghanistan. As we speak, there is the annual spring initiative that is not unlike perhaps the Tet Offensive, but this time in Afghanistan with the thawing and the warming weather and the increased ability of the people who live there to fight back against the invaders from the United States and NATO. Meanwhile, the Obama administration announced that it is beginning yet another military offensive inside Afghanistan to try and shore up an occupation that they say is intended to come to an end, but may not actually be intended to do so over the coming years. To help us understand that situation, we are now joined live with Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She is a frequent traveler to such parts of the world and has herself recently returned from Afghanistan. Welcome back to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Kathy.
Hello, Robert. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, it seems that war has no end in Afghanistan. There, in the wake of the slaughter about which you complained so passionately, of the night missions and the cover-up of that, in regard to the Quran burnings, and now the continuing operation of what I consider similar to the Phoenix program in Vietnam, where civilian deaths are used as a means of intimidating resistant local residents and organizations. Can we begin with just you reflecting on what you know about Afghanistan at this moment of crisis?
Well, people in Afghanistan have endured four decades of warfare, and the weariness is so high. We should also keep in mind 65% of the people are under 25 years of age. The average life expectancy is, for women, 42.2 years, for men, 42.6 years, and 250 children die every day of starvation. Meanwhile, $2 billion is being spent every week to maintain the United States warfare there. And, you know, there was an interesting article in the American Spectator by a fellow named Neil Shea, in which he, as an embedded reporter, talks about a night raid wherein he accompanied United States troops, and the staff sergeant in charge said, "We just did a week of recruitment for the Taliban." And what did he mean? Well, the soldiers themselves know that when they conduct night raids, or when drones attack civilians, or when there are airborne attacks that kill children on a mountainside collecting, you know, scrap for fuel, that this is, in a sense, prompting more people to say, yes, we'll join the Taliban, or we'll support the Taliban. And the staff sergeant then said, and it's job security for us, meaning it'll keep the United States troops there. Well, in fact, the strategic partnership agreement that the United States is pressuring Hamid Karzai's government to sign will keep United States troops, particularly the Special Operations Forces, in Afghanistan until 2024 or beyond. And we can't help but wonder, does that have to do with U.S. designs on building pipelines and roadways in order to maintain large networks of forward operating bases and military presence that will pose a threat to Russia, to China, to Iran, and get a leg up on controlling the pricing and the flow of resources in that country.
Kathy Kelly, I too am pessimistic about the lies that are being told about an imminent withdrawal from Afghanistan. In Iraq, we have seen the trick of keeping troops and bases there, but simply changing the name of the occupation soldiers to non-combat troops. You may startle some people when you say that the United States occupation of Afghanistan is intended to go well into the 2020s, yet President Obama and the Democrats and everybody are saying that, we're planning to withdraw this year, next year, 2014. Can you explain why your projected date is at least a decade beyond the promises that are being made in this election campaign year?
Well, this is, again, the Strategic Partnership Agreement. In Iraq, it was called the Status of Forces Agreement. And what the United States is seeking is a deal in which they will turn the ownership of some of the bases over to the Afghans, and the United States will become tenants of those bases. It's also important to recall that there are three new prisons being built to the tune of $100 million. And it's unlikely that the United States is going to say, oh, well, we didn't really want to have any control over those. And the United States is also building what will become the world's very largest embassy in Kabul. Right now, the largest embassy is in Baghdad. But since the United States is shifting so much of its focus to Central Asia, they will want a very, very huge embassy in Kabul. Keeping the troops there for a much longer stretch, of course, also means that these troops can be, in a sense, accompanied by the mercenaries or the security contractors. When you fly over to Afghanistan from, say, Dubai, three-fourths of the plane generally is filled by people who are doing jobs for Western companies or employed within NGOs or are doing security. So there's an enormous amount of money that's being spent. Also, the United States will rely increasingly on robotized warfare. The colloquial word is drones for surveillance, and sometimes the weaponized drones are also used to fire hellfire missiles or drop 500-pound bombs. And this allows the United States to withdraw troops, but it doesn't mean that our spending on military is going to go down. In fact, it will continue to go up, according to the Pentagon's own statistics. The new kind of warfare that the United States will be engaging in, for instance, requires right now 65,000 to 70,000 analysts who study the footage that's acquired by the remote piloted drone aircraft, which can be piloted, if you will, out of Creech Air Force Base in Nevada or Hancock Field in Syracuse. And there are many more places, including Fort McCoy in Wisconsin, where people are being trained to operate these airborne vehicles. Says, okay, 65,000 to 70,000 Air Force personnel to scrutinize what would be the equivalent of 58,000 full-length feature films. And the RAND Corporation says, well, really, you'd need 100,000 analysts to study all that film footage in order to, and this is a quote, better understand patterns of life in Afghanistan. Well, to me, if you want to understand patterns of life in Afghanistan, you know, come with voices when we go and live in a working class neighborhood and we walk past areas where people are on the streets and they don't have housing, or go to the Chadhi Khambar refugee camp and realize that there are 400 new refugees every day displaced by the war. Talk with women who don't have a breadwinner in the family any longer because the husband and four of his friends were killed when they were sipping tea in the garden. Get to know young Fazila and her child, Aymal, and the mother-in-law who's so furious. She says, what was the evidence that her son should be killed? Or get to know the people who don't have electricity and can't vary their diet beyond potatoes and bread and rice, which is the majority of the people in Afghanistan right now.
You make the point that the military occupation continues under the process of civilianizing and making the same arrogant people who acted arrogantly as soldiers act arrogantly as private contractors. We've seen this occur in Iraq and elsewhere, and that seems to be underway in Afghanistan as well. In regard to the dickering that will take place over the so-called status agreement with Afghanistan, what would you warn people to be alert about the rhetorical tricks that will be played by the Obama administration and by the Republicans and others and the military manufacturers? How do we avoid going into the trance of thinking we're talking about a withdrawal in a year or two or a short period of time when, as you say, there seem to be plans for it to go to 2024 at least? What would you tell people to do to keep from being fooled by these rhetorical diversions?
Well, I think it's a very good idea in New York to go to Congressman Tierney's website and check out the research that his staff have done 2 years running that shows how so much of the $2 billion per week spent on the war has gone into the pockets of drug lords and warlords, Afghan drug lords, Afghan warlords, who are quite corrupt and who have said to the United States, look, if you want your 6,000 to 8,000 trucks to deliver supplies to all of your troops, mm-hmm. that's going to cost you. You're going to have to pay rent, more or less, to use our stretch of highway. And the rents are as high as the market will bear. And Congressman Tierney has examined this 2 years in a row, put out a full report, and you barely hear boo about that. So it's important to be in touch with that. I think it's also very important to object to the idea of a humanitarian war. I think the United States State Department has really tried many various means of propaganda, even one PBS special about women in war that shows U.S. women soldiers bouncing babies in their arms while they've got guns on their back. And there's no such thing as a humanitarian war.
That's an obscene film.
Children die every single day. And so to object to that kind of heinous propaganda, I also think it's a good idea to try to listen to voices of people from Afghanistan. Please join us this Saturday, April 21st, for a Global Days of Listening phone call, where the young people from Afghanistan will talk with young people from other parts of the world. It's an interesting afternoon, and several people in Long Island and other parts of New York are taking key roles in that. That's April 21st, and we welcome people just to go to globaldaysoflistening.com and be part of that. The United States State Department and the Pentagon will no doubt try to make it seem, for electioneering purposes, I think, that the United States is following the will of the people. Well, keep in mind, right now, 69% of the U.S. public is weary of this war. But I'd like to say something that maybe a large majority of that 69% won't want to hear, but I'd still say it anyway. We should be paying reparations. Reparations for the suffering caused. Mm. The United States has ravaged Afghanistan, and so have the Soviet troops when the Soviet Union existed and had invaded other countries, Pakistan included, I think, owe reparations for suffering caused in that country. It would be possible to rebuild the infrastructure. It would be possible to replenish the flocks, to reseed the orchards, to clean up and repair the irrigation systems, but it would cost a great deal of money that people in Afghanistan certainly don't have. The UN has said it's the poorest country in the world into which a child can be born. So what to do? I don't want to minimize the difficulties, but I don't think that the United States, with its track record, should be the supervising group by any means for any kind of reconstruction assistance. I think we could turn to the agencies of the United Nations. There are 38 agencies, and many of them are so very, very good, the ones that are trying to clear mines, and the World Health Organization, the United Nations Development Program, the World Food Program. These are people who have shown that they have some empathy, and Afghanistan is in a very, very difficult situation. But I think it's very wrongful for the United States to try and overcome the Vietnam syndrome by, A, making sure nobody ever sees any visual images of the suffering caused in Afghanistan by U.S. presence. We also never see troops coming back who are either coming back in coffins or have come back traumatized or as amputees. This is something that's not very well known by the U.S. public. And then the other thing that the U.S. has deliberately done is make an effort to present this as a humanitarian war. But I think that the killing spree that happened when Sergeant Bales allegedly went out and killed 17 Afghan civilians is not an aberration. U.S. soldiers under orders.
It's SOP.
Afghan civilians.
Sure. Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, apparently the income from the Karzai family's alleged involvement in the opium trade is insufficient. And we have this news item of his saying that he wants at least an ongoing, at least $2 billion a year from the United States. He was speaking to some students, and he's quoted as saying, the United States says, we will give you money, but will not specify the amount. We say, give us less, but write it down. We want them to write down what America will give for Afghanistan security, $2 billion a year, or at least $2 billion a year. If they want to give us more, they are welcome. And I think that pretty much indicates the level of real concern about this so-called humanitarian war and the expansion of the military complex of the United States and the bamboozling of people whose more recent fears in the United States have given permission for global travesty. Kathy, in the closing minutes of today's program, I'd like you to take a moment to speak about your own travels and the ongoing work of Voices for Creative Nonviolence in Afghanistan and what kind of immersion experience and enlightenment comes from that.
Well, thank you. You know, we like our name, but in a way, I cringe a little bit if anybody thinks that we're teaching nonviolence to people in Afghanistan, because that's certainly not what happens. We go and learn from the Afghan youth peace volunteers, and increasingly the very dynamic and wide array of people who come to be with them. And we live in a working class area. It's called Carte Se. It's an ample spot, but in the winter weather, everybody crowds into one room and just stays in that room all the time unless you're cooking something or relieving yourself, because it's just so cold, and the only means of heat was a wood-burning stove. There wasn't any running water because the pipes had frozen, and, you know, we actually had to melt snow in order to get water at certain points. Very often there wasn't electricity. It's frustrating when you're accustomed to being able to send an email whenever you want. Well, forget that. Only 3% of all the people in Afghanistan have access to the Internet. So the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers are really quite amazing to me. They are themselves young people who went through a lot of trauma, displacement into refugee camps, watching their parents killed before their eyes, brothers that were tortured. I mean, it's so hard for them to be in touch with their own memories, but they don't want to see the spirals of violence continue. So it's really interesting to see Pashto and Hazara and Tajik youngsters living together and to watch them really try, carefully, but try to integrate women into their work as well and to document what they're doing. And we're very, very fortunate to watch them. And their plan for December 10th, 2012 is to have 2 million friends join them in commemorating the 2 million people killed over four decades of warfare. Beyond Afghanistan, we'll light candles inside the country. They'll hold various kinds of vigils. And they've done caravans between provinces. They've risked their lives. They've walked together. They've really hung together. Last weekend, it was terrible. There were explosions morning, noon, night, and the following morning. So do stay in touch with them. All of your listeners who might want to be connected, it's easy. Just go to globaldaysoflistening.com or to their website, ourjourneytosmile.com, or visit us at vcnv.org, the Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And, of course, we know that WBAI does a lot to keep people appraised of what's happening in Afghanistan, and we really do have to look beyond our mainstream news and allow other people to educate us who are living in the crosshairs of our war.
Well, I thank you for your compassion and your insight and your global knowledge and protection of the continuing efforts to maintain infinite war. And I thank you for that, Kathy Kelly, for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And we'll stay in touch, and good luck on the 21st.
Well, thank you. And if anybody wants to join us walking from Madison, Wisconsin to Chicago, May 1st to 17th, we'll bring our agenda that we think NATO should look at. And the NATO summit will be happening in Chicago on the 20th and 21st. So please come to Chicago, won't you? Please come to Chicago. And if you want to come early and walk with us, we'd love to hear from you.
All right, Kathy Kelly.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was produced by Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your leaks, tips, suggestions, and queries with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. That's theshadow@wbai.org. And if you're out of town, we stream live at stream.wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.